three lessons you can learn from Elon Musk. He gives himself so many more at-bats, so many more chances to fail or to win.
We don't get to see the levels of frustration or challenges that the company was facing.
Well, I mean, I think it's not scale for scale's sake. It's just like if you say, well, we want to accomplish these goals, then you kind of have to make a big thing.
You're better off solving something that's so hard to do. And his reasoning was because nobody will be doing it, but everyone will know when you succeed.
Welcome back. This is Stephanie Postles. Albert, how's it going?
It's going pretty good. How was your, it wasn't really a sabbatical, but you didn't record for
1 week. I had 1 week off. I did go into my vacation with a goal of not to work, and I failed, so maybe next time. But it was nice to take the break from recording for 1 week. But now we're back, and today we're here because of actually a more personal experience that we're going to pull into life. So to give you the story of where this concept's coming from, the three lessons you can learn from Elon Musk, I have a Tesla, and all of a sudden, I started seeing that Tesla was pushing full self-driving, trying to get people who had Teslas to buy the full self-driving package, which I had not seen them pushing this as much. They had here and there, but they hadn't really asked me to buy it like they have recently. And so I started looking into, why are they pushing this concept so hard? Why is this something they really want people to be buying into? And I went down this whole rabbit hole of looking at what they've been doing over the last decade with this self-driving technology. And after looking into it, I realized there were so many good life lessons just from this one case study from Tesla that's what we're going to talk about today. So for full self-driving, Elon and team at Tesla have been working on this for over a decade. And up until about 2023, they had been working in the same model with the same type of code where their engineers were going in there and they were doing a lot of manual labor to identify stop signs, circle, there's a roadblock, there's a line in the road, trying to train a model of how a Tesla should operate when it's in self-driving mode, which is what a lot of other companies have been doing. When I worked at Google, they did it this way. I mean, you have these huge teams in India just circling things all day long to identify what things are. And so that's what they've been doing for 10 years to work on getting their cars to have self-driving. And about last year in 2023, all of a sudden, there was a pivot to what's called FSD 12, so version 12, and they essentially scrapped everything they had really done. Many of the main structures of how they were building out this model, they scrapped the processes for how they were doing it and instead went to a brand new one. So they're not circling things now. They're not doing things manually. They're not forcing their own rules. Like, it's not a rule-based approach anymore of like, we think these are the rules and this is how a car should operate. Instead, they're relying on human drivers, the best ones, the ones who are, you know, like he called it a five-star Uber driver. Like, what are they doing? And they're letting their information, their driving incidents, their like edge cases where, you know, something flies out into the road in front of them and the person jerks away from it. They're letting those edge cases train the model in real time. And they did this shift pretty, I would say, abruptly. And when I'm watching the shift, it made me think, one, how much easier this model feels than the other one. Like the first model, it required so many more people to do so many more things, constantly trying to figure out and predict what was going to happen. And then you move to a model like this, and it's like, okay, let's decentralize our data. Let drivers give us the data. Let our models learn from all these drivers. And now they're exponentially scaling, and you see that now they have a path to actually get to self-driving. And it perfectly highlights the concept Occam's razor, which is usually the simplest explanation is the best one. I mean, there's so many Tesla drivers out there with so much data. I mean, these cars have 12 cameras on them. And so they're constantly ingesting data. And so now you're allowing an entire fleet of people to be capturing data for you, which that was the limitation. They didn't have enough data and they were trying to predict what was going to happen by circling certain examples or trying to predict, oh, if someone maybe does this, here's how you would handle it. Like everything was code and rule-based. And so in this case, instead, it's usually this visual data from a lot more data points that's constantly getting updated. And then they're giving weights to the people who are the best drivers and then training it on that of like, how would the best driver react if something flies off the back of a pickup truck and is flying towards them? How would they react then? Or how would they react if something rolls out into the middle of a highway and they have two cars on the side of them? And that's the stuff that you really couldn't code for. And I think that's what was also causing quite a bit of the issues when people were talking about self-driving is that they're like, there's too many areas that a car doesn't know how to interact with that circumstance. And I know I've seen it in my own Tesla when it would think that a line was coming or something and it would like jerk the car really quickly. Like I have had that happen before. And I'm like, that has to be software being like, if you see a line like this, jerk away from it. I mean, it's coded in there somewhere to do that. And so instead of working off these rules, now it's saying, hey, let's let the entire fleet of drivers that are driving our Teslas influence these models in a real world way. And so that to me, even though I'm sure I know there's a ton of still code and engineers and people working on this, you went from something that after 10 years had no chance of scaling. And now you're in a new model where all of a sudden it seems like they're on a path to being able to figure this out much sooner than they ever could have.
Yeah. So when I hear this news, I don't know if I quite think it's all of a sudden. So here's what's interesting about the term abruptly, right? Is that we don't get to see the levels of frustration or challenges that the company was facing prior to making this decision. You also don't get to know how long something was evaluated before a decision was made. So to the outside world, it can be abrupt, but to them, it could have been like a long calculated approach. But or the other here or there, the reality is that he or the company has an objective. They wanted full self-driving vehicles. They had a process and procedure that they were operating under. It sounds to me, this is more taking advantage of new technology that's available to you. That's what it feels like to me is like they, hey, listen, visual modeling probably, if I know for a fact, was not as good 10 years ago. So they get introduced to the new way that you can visually model things based on machine learning. And he is now saying, or the company is now saying, hey, how do we get more footage of road events so that we don't have to be a small group of people codifying and figuring this out? So they decided, hey, the only way we get good is to get wider, bigger, right? We need more evidence. We need more data points. We need more footage. We need to see what it is like in the real world because most people cannot code for all the things that they don't know. You can't code for things you don't know or haven't seen or can't predict. So they definitely changed the way they do things. Whether it's Occam's razor, I don't know if that's the case, but for sure he's taking advantage of a better way of doing something. So he's not, we talked about it earlier, he's not so sunk in the process of what they are doing. It's more like, he is quickly recognizing that there is possibly a new way. Now, when did he recognize it? I'm not sure. My guess is Tesla's been looking at this for a while, and then they just made the announcement. That's all. Like, the announcement was because after like 2-3 years of testing, they're like, this is it. We're going after this.
Yeah, when I think of, we'll get to the sunk cost thing as our second takeaway, but for the Occam's razor, when I'm thinking about a simpler solution, I'm also thinking about an element of control, like how they had it before. And this is many companies who are designing things. I mean, I saw it at Google all the time. We have to make our own thing, do our own code. Everything has to be in-house. Like, we're the only ones who know. And by what they're doing, I mean, they're moving to a much more open source model. They're literally taking code that anyone can use and they're pulling it into their models, like releasing control and allowing a lot bigger of a pool of code, of data. So to me, when you let go of that amount of control, I think things get simpler because now you have a whole workforce working for you, whether it be open source developers, whether it be the drivers. So it's more just letting in the help in a much wider scale. So that's how I was kind of thinking about it with Occam's razor. But either way, in general, in life, I'm like, the simpler solution might be the best one. And I do think it's easy to pick the hardest one with the most control, where you're doing everything yourself and not look up and be like, oh, there might be an easier way to do this, or a simpler one, or one that can scale quicker because I let other people in to partner with me, help me, whatever it might be.
Yeah, there's no question. People hate simple things. They just do. It's also because they don't like things that are, when something seems so easy that it's obvious, most people choose to not do that because they believe that everyone else will be doing it. And this Occam's razor thing always, to me, falls back to, is very more similar to, like, you know, lean startup principles. But I'm in agreement, like, whatever you can do that is something you can do and quickly do is always, to me, the best decision path to go down, because you actually have to be, this is the one thing that I, when I talk to people, that I think it's weird. Nobody thinks that it's going to be hard to get good at the thing. So, like, if you listen to how people choose the decisions that they make, the effort it takes to get good at it is never a consideration, which is really weird, right? And instead, they just jump to, oh, yeah, we should definitely start. And I'll use examples of, like, building software is pretty pretty normal for us to talk about since so many people are in the tech world that listen to this show. It's like they want to build something that's really hard to build, use a language that they're not familiar with. It's like, but I don't understand why you think that you'll be super good at it instead of using something they do know to create more of a lean startup principle. It is a common thing that happens. It definitely is.
Yeah. No, I do agree about the choosing the more complicated path. But then I also think when people don't think about how much time it might take for them to get good at something, I think that naiveness is actually a good thing because that's how most companies have been built. I mean, you hear all these founders, they're like, if I knew what I know now, I would never rebuild this company. I mean, I think NVIDIA CEO said this.
Knowing what you know now, would you start NVIDIA again? He's like, no.
Yeah. So I'm like, and I think that's, I've heard that from a lot of founders at huge companies where they're like, the stress, the toll, how hard this industry was. Like, I would be now fearful to get into this kind of space, but I was so naive back then that I thought I could do anything. So I do think that mindset, you know, is what has built some of the greatest companies in the world. And yes, sometimes there are also people who just choose the hardest route where it's like, why? Here's an easy one right here.
If you're not the type of person that constantly, let's say, thrives with adversity, then you should definitely be the one that chooses the simpler path.
Yep. Yeah.
I mean, some people just love it. Some people love chaos or feel like they need to. I remember talking to Simeon Dikach, who was the managing partner or founder of One Way Ventures. He talked about why does he invest in refugees? Because he says refugees, by default, have no other way but success. And they've already gone to the ends of the world to solve the huge, biggest problem, like, you know, freedom. How do I obtain freedom for myself? That not knowing code, not knowing financing, that's not going to stop them from succeeding. And so I thought that was pretty cool while remembering that conversation I had with him, which I agree with you is like, so the, for the biggest moonshots, typically, you are going to need that attitude that I can learn this.
Yeah. And I think if you have an excitement behind something, that's something I've heard quite a lot recently, where it's like, if you have a really high excitement towards something, even if it's hard, you will be able to push past anything that is too hard because you're so excited about it. And that's something that I think a lot of people miss out on. Like if you have a lot of excitement and something's hard, you can't be deterred, which is great. You're like, this is my highest excitement and it might take many years and I don't care because this is what I want to do. Whereas other people, if you're just picking something hard, but you actually don't have excitement behind it. I mean, we've talked about this previously, but I feel like your efforts will begin to degrade because you don't have that passion internally driving you to be like, I don't care how hard this is something I really like or I really care about.
And that's why money's a lot of VCs talk about it. Money's a terrible motivator because if you're doing something super hard, inevitably it'll get to the point where you should probably do something else. And there's always probably someone else who will pay you a little bit more. So it's easy for someone to drop a project if money is the motivator.
Yep. Yeah, I agree. So I want to go back to what you mentioned earlier. So we already had our first one that we were like, okay, Occam's razor, somehow I could or could not relate. I still think it's something interesting to think about throughout life. But the second one you brought up was sunk costs. And I'd love to talk about the sunk cost fallacy, because that was something when I was looking at this story where I'm like, billions of dollars spent, so much headcount, 10 years of investment into building the modules and the pieces that you need to get this code working. I mean, imagine being some of those people who are like, we're almost there. We just need a few more things. And we're like 80% of the way there. And to some people, it'd be pretty hard looking at that being like, no, there's $1 billion or more invested in here. I don't even know the amount. I know it's big though. And this people, they put 10 years of their life in there. We got to keep moving on because we've invested so much and there's so much cost. And I thought, man, that's a good question right there. How many of us look around at something and we're like, we put a lot of money in here. We had this relationship. I've been in this relationship for 10 years. Like, I can't just jump out of it now, or I can't stop my business now. I've been doing it for a long time and all my life's money is in there. And like that sunk cost fallacy that holds us, yeah, in a state of like a prison because we're holding on to what was instead of just doing what this story I am at least picturing it as is like, okay, we're done with that. We got to shift over to something better. Yeah. $1 billion. Yeah. 10 years. Yeah. Whatever that was. Like, it's time to, you know, switch routes real quick because this one's not scaling or this relationship's not working or this company's not working or this job's not working. And I need to make a quick pivot. And I don't care actually what has gone in, you know, into the past to get me here. I just know I have a new future and I need to quickly pivot to get into a different timeline of my life.
There's only three moments of life: the past, the present, and the future. And if you tell me everything I've done in the past is not going to help my future, to me, it's pretty easy to do something different. Like, I don't, when I hear people that say that they have to continue, I don't really understand. I just don't. When I think about that concept, is like, I must continue down this path because of what happened in the past. And then you think to yourself, well, are you happy with what happened in the past? Is it like heading towards something good? And so many people don't really have an answer. They're just like, well, this is what I've always known. It's what I've always done. It's like, all right, so I guess that sounds good. But to me, it's nonsensical. Like, it's hard for me to conceptualize. But I also personally, the reason why I don't suffer from sunk cost fallacy is because I am not tied to anything. And, you know, my videographer over here, Hollywood Hurt, he likes to joke about it. It's like, you can give away and say no to anything in your life outside of my children. But I think that's pretty true. You know what I mean? Like, when I was younger, did I have a hard time breaking up with people? No. I was like, okay, this relationship has ended. I don't see a future, therefore it's now finished. But that's just a personal opinion. So for me, it's hard to relate to people who believe that they've invested so much that they have to continue.
But what if it's not even investing so much that you have to continue? Let me see what this example might do. Because I do agree, like, the big things, that's an easier one to look at. Like, hey, your business isn't working, your relationship, whatever it might be. It's like, this thing's been going on a long time. And if you don't have something drastically different, like, why would you keep putting more effort into that? That piece, I understand. But there's one that I see happen a lot, and it's around food. This is one example of many micro moments of someone getting into, like, a sunk cost. You go out to dinner. I bought this dessert. I try it, and I'm like, it's not that good. But then I sit there. I don't, but I watch other people sit there and eat something, even though they don't like it, because they're like, well, I paid money for that. And in my head, I'm like, whether it's in your stomach or it stays on that plate, you already spent the money. It doesn't matter. You don't have to finish the food. But in their mind, it's like, well, I invested in this. I put money into this. I need to actually finish it and, like, follow all the way through. And to me, those are the things, like, mini moments throughout life where people are like, think like, oh, I put cost into this. Now I got to eat that thing. I got to finish my whole plate. Like, those are the ones that I think also can add up. Not just always the big ones, but, like, how is your brain training you to finish that thing of food? Because it's got to be in your stomach to complete the job, to make it worth the money that you paid.
I mean, I do it for sure. If I pay for something, I'm going to finish it.
Okay. Why? If you don't like it, not just because you're going to finish it, but, like, why?
I have, so there you go. Well, it's got to be really bad for me to not finish it. So I have not finished something before. I do recall throwing away a Goodfellas pizza out of business, Winston-Salem. My wife was at Wake Forest Law School. We ordered a pizza. It was honestly the worst thing I've ever had in my life. I didn't eat it. It was that bad. But so I guess I don't subscribe. But in general, I would say food to me, it's very rare where I'll have something so bad that I don't. I mean, even if you give me the completely wrong order, if I think it tastes okay, I'll just eat it.
Yeah, I'm more thinking about not even actual food, like desserts and candy and stuff that's not actually, like, nutritional.
They believe if they eat one cookie that they can just eat all the cookies. So they're like, you know, well, there's no turning back. Why would I leave?
Yeah.
There's 24 cookies. I ate 12 of them. I might as well finish the other 12. That is a very common decision.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people make.
Yeah. So that's the kind of decisions where I'm like, how many times do people feel like, well, I already am so far into this. Now I got to finish it.
If I were to debate that, that's more impulse. They don't think that eating 12 cookies will ruin their life. They also think avoiding 12 cookies will better their life. So it doesn't really have a weight. Now, you can say over the course of a lifetime of eating, that will add up. That, I believe, to be true. But that decision is a very impulsive decision. I don't know if it's a good indicator. Let me put it this way. There's a lot of successful people that are super fat. So I think eating habits and success are not correlated at all. Mark Benioff's fat. Elon Musk looks like a giant pale piece of Play-Doh.
I mean, does he now? I feel like he looks jacked now.
He's got the same color and texture as a mashed potato, too. Kind of whippy, lumpy, like mixed with butter. Like, he's not, dude. Elon Musk could not run a mile under 10 minutes.
I'm looking for Elon Musk's shirt off.
Plus, he looks like shit at all times. Like, he looks stressed to the max. I mean, he doesn't care about himself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm looking at pictures. Maybe I'm thinking of Jeff Bezos. I'm thinking of Jeff Bezos then.
And Bezos didn't get jacked till after he was rich. Bezos, before he started Amazon, was already a very successful hedge fund operator. He was already super successful. He had this wiry, nerdy look. I mean, he wasn't caring about his health. Like, you know what I mean? And I'm sure he made plenty of impulsive decisions. So when I think of sunk cost fallacy, in general, if there's not enough penalty and or reward, then I think it's easier to, I just don't know if it matters as much. I think where it really becomes a big one is when there's in long-term relationships, in businesses, because we definitely see that. We see people stay together with boyfriends, girlfriends, married way too long because they think of all the past and what it could potentially be in the future. I definitely see that. That's hard to say no to. And I would say there is never too much costs to change your mind, I think. If you have the right information, if you have a good enough confidence interval that this new thing will be different, I don't see why the past would prevent you from making that decision. I do believe that to be true.
Yeah, you can always change your mind with everything.
That's right. That's why I love the 37 Singles guys, man. They don't even believe in planning. They're like, I just make decisions based on what I know today. Like plans, I have no plans.
Okay, so we said three lessons. Now we're at two. The third one that I took away from it, which I know we'll be kind of debating, is around failing fast, which I know you mentioned. Yeah, that this is not an Elon Musk thing. It's been done a long time before him. So this is not his thing. But I do think, he has some good examples of failing a lot and fast, not with Tesla, definitely, but also SpaceX, with a lot of things that he's involved in. That dude's not afraid to fail. And he's not afraid to fail publicly on TV. I'm launching a rocket. Oh, fuck that one.
He's definitely had rocket launches that have been televised that, didn't make it off the launch pad. So,
When looking through a lot of his launches and the things that he's doing, what I notice with him is that he gives himself so many more at-bats, so many more chances to fail or to win. But because he has so much more consistency around launching, around new versions of things, around different styles of cars, he just has more instances to see if he's going to succeed, which every entrepreneur knows, like the more at-bats you have, the more chances, the more willingness you have to try something, take on a risk, change something up. Like that is how you grow a company bigger, scale it, invent new products, invent new things. So watching what he's doing here, not just with this, but with his other companies, is a great reminder of like, are you doing something that's making you scared today? Are you choosing something that could have you fail publicly, could make you embarrassed, could have you choose something that's going to have you lose face in front of your company and your employees? Like, are you choosing risky but measurable decisions that you're betting on?
Yeah, I would simplify it some because not every one of us. So Elon is in a different position, right? Because he has earned the benefit of the doubt that he's a bit of a rainmaker. The things that he touches, he's a Midas man. They ultimately turn to gold. It's how he's been able to raise substantial amounts of money for. So if people want to look this up and forget their history, Tesla wasn't his company. He found out about a tester, became an investor in Tesla, continued to buy shares to create capital for them to keep investing in their vehicles. Ultimately, he really disagreed with how the CEO was running things. And he basically did a hostile takeover, right? He bought enough shares where he voted the guy out. And it's hard to say, did he make the right decision? Well, if you had invested at Tesla at that time versus how much its stock price is trading today, yes, you've made a fortune. Likewise, he took on X. X has not returned the same return. It is down a lot since he took over, and it's constantly in the news. So he's very public about what he wants to do and what he's trying to do. Because he has had such outsized success, people do continue to invest in him, which allows him to continue to play really hard games, right? I think like all the Hyperloop projects now, for example, are closed. Like none of them worked. So he's taking huge moonshots. He's making huge bets, and he's trying to do great things. For anyone who's trying to, if you're looking at that and say, well, I can't compare myself to him, I think you can, in that you still need to take as many at-bats as possible. And I will clearly define the at-bat as getting your product in front of your customer. I think that's one of the things that he's done more than anybody. Like he's made willing to put his customers, or excuse me, the products out in public so that people can check them out, see them. He famously, more recently with the Cybertruck, right? He shot an arrow at it or threw a rock at it. I can't remember because it claimed it was bulletproof. It shattered right there. Like that was definitely super embarrassing. I think the big thing for anyone who's listening is that you do not know if something's going to work unless you prototype it and bring it out into the public. Until a customer is touching it or cameras are filming and rolling, it's just an idea. It's just an idea that you think could potentially work and you can argue it ad nauseum. But until you put it out there, it really isn't a thing. There's a couple other things, businesses or lines of business that he's been a part of that really you haven't heard much from. They had big PR, but they haven't succeeded yet. I think to myself about like the acquisition of Solar City and the solar panels, the tile solar panels. I think that's a big, huge moonshot. People don't criticize him too much for having not really brought that to market yet. The trucks I've heard good buzz about, like some people have been trying out the trucks, the semis. Yeah. I think that's going to be interesting. And of course, Cybertruck is now finally in the market. He's definitely gotten criticized for some of the things for Cybertruck. But he kind of has a way of saying like, well, it's V1 or V10. Or, that's where it is today. It is no bearing on where it's going to be tomorrow. In fact, what we learned today is what's going to make it better tomorrow. In general, I would say for anyone who's trying to innovate, build business, build services, whatever, that methodology is pretty critical. I see more businesses die due to overplanning than I do from being afraid to fail fast. You know what I mean? Like overplanning will kill you because you will put way too much cash down and generate no revenue from it. So eventually that'll end in nothing.
The last thing I'll add that I do appreciate about Elon is that, and this is from a more energetic spiritual approach, I feel like he gets out there and says things, I'm doing this, and his energy towards his projects, he says it and people are like, you're not building a truck. That's not going to get out in time. But I like his gumption behind his projects of like, I'm doing this, I'm doing that, I'm doing this. This is what you can expect of me. And even when he's missing deadlines or even when it doesn't look like there's a path to build that or even when he doesn't know if partners are going to come on his charging stations, I like how he comes at his projects with so much certainty that there has to be an energetic exchange of putting out that confidence, that excitement into the world and moving forward, being like, this is what I'm doing and this is what I'm excited about and this is what's going to change the world. So I think having that too with like whatever you're doing, I mean, what I see is so many people being scared to say what they're going to do because the second they say it, people are going to hold them accountable. People are going to be like, hey, where'd that company go that you're going to build? Where'd that product go? Where'd that, you know, course that you were going to build? The second you get out there and you announce it, I'm building this thing, I'm doing this thing, I'm launching this thing, you then have eyes on you. And I also think it's putting out an energy of like, this is something I get to do now. And now people are watching. And yeah, you're going to be a force of good if you're actually putting it out there, if something you care about that you, you know, announce to the world.
Well, I'm going to disagree with you on one small caveat is I wouldn't worry about people watching you. I think that is something that people often overcalculate, which prevents them from taking big, bold bets themselves, is they think that other people will care. You are at free and at will to go try huge things. I think we were just talking about him earlier, but Jensen Huang is now one of the wealthiest people on earth. They just released Blackwell, the new AI processing. I don't even know what to call it. It's not a chip. It's like a machine. For NVIDIA, but he used to always do talks and about like how you, if you're going to solve a problem, you're better off solving something that's such a moonshot and so hard to do. And his reasoning was because nobody will be doing it and no one will know that you haven't done it, but everyone will know when you succeed. You know what I mean? So it's like you get to build in the dark because what you're doing is so freaking hard. He was known for that at NVIDIA. His story is becoming more to light now because now more people know who he is. But like I read about how he took twice as long to finish his graduate degree in computer science, how he went to like reform school in Kentucky because his parents thought he was an idiot. Like there's a lot, you know, he's legendary. You know, he worked at Denny's. Like NVIDIA was started by a bunch of guys at Denny's. When you hear that, you're like, how's this possible? And it's like, well, he talks about how they were doing something incredibly hard, very quietly for a really long time. Did you see his talk he did to Stanford recently where he told everyone?
No.
He says everyone has the problem with this generation, he says, is they all have high expectations. And he said, yes, you should have high expectations. You're at Stanford. You've graduated with a computer science degree. You should have high expectations. He says the problem is that entrepreneurship and success is saved for the resilient. The extremely resilient. And so because you've not gone through enough hard things, the likelihood you will succeed is so low. And I think that's probably Musk's superpower, is he constantly kicks himself in a way that makes it very difficult to succeed. You know, he famously, in the process of building Gigafactory, he had a couple admissions of defeat, essentially. One, they over-engineered the factory floors. They over-automated. He assumed everything could be done by robots. Turns out that's not true. So he had to get more technical still machinists, you know, to help make the cars. When they missed all their delivery numbers at Tesla early in the days, he, of course, wanted the entire floor redone. He was known for sleeping at the factory. We have to do this. So he had to incorporate some of his vision for automation with some of the current world, like what's available to him today kind of concept. Mm-hmm. But in his defense, he recognized that, and he was willing to be public, know that he missed deliveries for Tesla, and still have an answer for how he was. If you remember, like, waiting for the Model 3, like, the Model 3 was one of the, in hindsight, it's fine. But at the time, people were freaking out. I remember mm-hmm. people had beta deposits on the Model 3 and like, dude, this is like a year behind.
Yeah. Yeah. They were very delayed. People were wondering if they were even going to get them. They're like, is this all like smokes and mirrors back here? Are we actually going to get a car?
What is going on? And it was not pleasant. I'm sure for him, like when the public has given you billions of dollars in cash loans, of which you have to repay with a car and their money back, but you've sunk it in automation that doesn't work. And now you have to hire a bunch of people to make it work. But he's definitely not afraid to be criticized.
And for that talk, we'll definitely link it up in the show notes. I want to check it out because I haven't seen it yet, but it sounds like a good one.
Oh, with Jensen Huang? Yeah, he's like, I hope you have terrible things happen to you, kind of.
Well, there you go. We'll leave this episode off on a happy note then. Just there you go. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. Hit the subscribe button. Follow us on YouTube. Wherever you're watching, viewing, we thank you and appreciate you being here with us.